Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Friday, April 16th. Along with Joe, Willie, and me, we have historian and Rogers Chair in the American Presidency at Vanderbilt University, John Meacham. He occasionally unofficially advises President Joe Biden. And award-winning historian, professor, and writer, Keisha N. Blaine. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. There is a lot that we are covering this morning. The new round of strict sanctions that the U.S. levied on Russia, the comments from the CEO of Pfizer that the need for COVID booster shots is looking more and more likely. Today marks 100 days since the deadly Capitol insurrection, and we have new details on that glaring warning signs that were ignored by Capitol Police days before the riot broke out. We will have the very latest from Minnesota, where the former officer charged in the death of Dante Wright made her first court appearance yesterday. And the defense rests in the murder trial of former officer Derek Chauvin. A lot going on, Willie.
Yeah, but first, we're following breaking news this morning of yet another mass shooting in America. Police say at least 8 people are dead. Several others are injured after a gunman opened fire at a FedEx warehouse near the Indianapolis airport. Police also say the suspected gunman took his own life. Officers responded to reports of shots fired just after 11 p.m. local time. At this point, police have not said whether the shooter was an employee of the facility, but an investigation is underway. We will have all the developments in this story as they come in. Mika, this is just breaking to us over the last few hours. We're sifting through the details. We'll get much more on it throughout the morning.
Yeah, but let's go now to the murder trial of Derek Chauvin. The former officer decided against taking the stand yesterday. Chauvin invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, passing up his final chance to give his side of the story to the jury.
Have you made a decision today whether you intend to testify or whether you intend to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege?
I will invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege today.
With that decision, the defense rested its case. Let's bring in Professor of Law at Georgetown University, Paul Butler. He's an MSNBC legal analyst and former U.S. attorney, now an NBC News law enforcement analyst. Chuck Rosenberg is with us this morning. Good to have you,
gentlemen. Thank you for being with us. Paul Butler, was it just too much of a risk for the defense to put the defendant on the stand? And were you expecting this? Was this a surprise, or did you think this was the most prudent move for the defense?
Joe, the conventional wisdom was that this person would not take the stand precisely because it was a great risk. Jurors like to hear from the person who was on trial. But if Chauvin had taken the stand, he risked being destroyed on cross-examination. Prosecutors would have taken him through every second of that 9-minute and 29-second video. And he might have opened the door to the juror hearing about the many complaints that citizens have filed against him in other cases.
Chuck, are juries more or less likely to convict a defendant because they refuse to testify?
Yeah, I don't know that they're more or less likely. They're instructed, Joe, by the judge that Mr. Chauvin, like all defendants, has a Fifth Amendment right, an absolute privilege not to testify, and they're told to ignore that. And so for what it's worth, I probably tried 50 or so criminal cases in federal court. Can count on one hand the number of times that a defendant would testify. It's rare. And I think jurors really, truly do try and follow the instructions of a judge to put that aside and to not hold it against him. And by the way, you know, Paul's exactly right. Chauvin would have been subjected to a withering cross. But remember, the core of his defense at this trial was that he did not cause Mr. Floyd's death. right, that Mr. Floyd died because of underlying health reasons and the like. And so Chauvin's testimony, had he taken the stand, could not have gone to that central issue. He doesn't know anything about cause of death. So it also, for the reasons that Paul stated, but also it makes sense not to take the stand if you really can't add anything that's going to materially help you.
Yeah. So, Chuck, with all the experience that you've had trying cases and being a professional prosecutor for years, most of us look at this trial and we think it's a fairly open and shut case for the prosecution. But of course, in these sort of cases involving police officers, it's never an open and shut case. So knowing that, if you're on this prosecution's team and the jury's going into deliberation, what are you going to be most concerned about?
I was always concerned, Joe, about that one juror for whatever reason who didn't get it or didn't care. Look, I think the prosecution did a terrific job. I thought their presentation was compelling. It was logical. It was linear. I thought they adduced facts in a really thoughtful way. I thought their experts were wonderful. So if I had a bet, and I'm not a betting guy, the prosecution has done everything it should do and would likely prevail, except for one thing. You need 12 jurors. It must be unanimous. One holdout juror, and you can always have somebody on the panel who doesn't see it the way the prosecution saw it. One holdout juror can mean the difference between a conviction and a hung jury, which is a mistrial. And that's what I always worried about. Even when I thought my case went well, even when I thought I proved everything I needed to prove, I worried about that holdout juror.
And Paul, I ask you the same question. Based on everything you've seen in the prosecution's case and now everything you've seen in the defense case, if you're worried about that one juror, what element of the case, what part of this trial would concern you most as a prosecution that put on a strong case? Is it the causation part? Are you worried that maybe one juror is going to listen to some of the testimony that says, well, he could still breathe, he could still talk, he could still, so it suggests that maybe it was drugs or maybe it was something, a weak heart that caused his death.
Joe, the prosecution presented one of the most compelling cases ever in the case of a police officer for murder, being prosecuted for murder. The defense had a very difficult time responding to the overwhelming evidence of excessive force. And you're right, if there's any issue that they're worried about, that the prosecution is worried about, it's causation, because the defense did a better job on the issue of what killed Mr. Floyd. Remember, they don't have to prove anything. All the defense has to do is raise reasonable doubt that Mr. Chauvin is responsible. So they let the jury consider a meth overdose, a fentanyl overdose, heart disease, lung disease, COVID-19, carbon monoxide poisoning. And now we'll have to see if that strategy worked with any of the jurors. If it just worked with one, that's a mistrial.
Chuck, Paul mentioned carbon monoxide. That was introduced by a defense expert, the former medical examiner in the state of Maryland, who suggested it could have been carbon monoxide poisoning that killed George Floyd as he was laying on the ground near the vehicle for so long. Well, the prosecution brought in another witness, actually brought back a witness, Dr. Martin Tobin, a pulmonologist, to refute that claim yesterday. Let's listen.
As to the statement that his carboxyhemoglobin could have increased by 10 to 18%, in your view, that's not possible.
It's simply wrong.
And it was at most 2%.
At most 2%.
Normal.
Which is normal.
So, Chuck, they're talking there about the oxygen saturation levels for George Floyd at 98%, which was normal, and saying it's simply wrong that carbon monoxide killed him. So as you look at the core defense for Officer Chauvin here from his team, it's that perhaps it was underlying health conditions or drugs that killed George Floyd. The prosecution had witnesses refuting that. Or that there was an angry, threatening crowd around Officer Chauvin, and somehow that compelled him to stay in that defensive crouch. Have they made those connections well enough in your judgment for a jury to have some doubt about the guilt of Officer Chauvin here?
I don't think so. I agree with Paul. I thought the case was compelling and logical and overwhelming. Look, the defense tried the angry crowd trope. And we saw the crowd, Willie. We saw the crowd that the officers saw.
Yep.
They were upset, but they were upset because a man was being killed, murdered in front of their eyes. They weren't threatening the police. And, oh, by the way, as the prosecution pointed out, the police on the scene didn't call for backup. They didn't feel that threatened. As to cause of death, look, I do think the defense did a better job here. I do think that they introduced or tried to introduce some doubt. The clip you just played of Dr. Tobin getting back on the stand in the prosecution's rebuttal case was done perfectly. It was short. It was to the point. It made the argument that the oxygen saturation levels were so high that it could not have been carbon monoxide poisoning. In fact, I remember Dr. Tobin saying that everybody in this room, referring to the courtroom in which he was sitting, has some amount of carbon monoxide in their system, no different than George Floyd did on the day that he died. And so I think that the prosecution by far had the better of the arguments and the better of the evidence. It remains to be seen how the jury reacts to it.
Keisha Blaine, want to get your thoughts here. And just, again, the argument about the carbon monoxide and the oxygen saturation, I mean, they laid him down by a tailpipe. So, I mean, again, it goes back to what officers, where they put him and what was done to his body as he was dying. I don't know if the defense wants to try and blame the victim in some way, but it's hard to watch.
It is. It's very hard to watch. And in fact, they, in many ways, they are trying to blame the victim. We've seen this over and over again, certainly in the case of Freddie Gray, as just one example. Also, the case of Eric Garner, over and over again, every time these incidences take place, rather than acknowledge the role of the police, there are all of these efforts to blame the victim, to ultimately suggest that they caused their own death. And so it's not surprising to see that trope again in this case.
John Meacham, talk about, we're moving through this trial and near the end of this trial of an event that in many ways transformed the United States last year, a tragedy that mobilized a nation and changed the conversation on race. As we move through this trial, what are your reflections? Is this something that may be looked back upon, this entire tragic episode, the same way as, say, the 1963 Birmingham church bombing?
Well, it's a great question. You never know what the timeline of reform is until you know how far the reform got, right? And so American history is, all history, is a kind of tension between, battle between reform and reaction. And the key element that faces us as a republic now is making real, producing results from the conversation on race. You know, a lot of friends I have said, you know, do we really need to have a conversation? You know, can't we take on the self-evident evidence of our eyes and experience and understand that policing reform is necessary, understanding that generational wealth is an essential question, understanding that systemic racism exists and must be confronted, and we do ourselves no favors by somehow thinking that that term, which a lot of folks on the center right and over think is overdrawn, we don't do ourselves as a country, for those who need an attempt fuller justice, we do ourselves and the country no favors. And so I think this trial, the death of George Floyd, in many ways, if you look back at the year of 2020, in a lot of ways, Lafayette Square, the events that unfolded in that terrible period, really brought home to people to whom it should not have been necessary to bring it home, I stipulate, that the Trump era had come to manifest many, many, many of our worst impulses. And so I have a theory that in the national mind, to some extent, Joe Biden kind of became president-elect during Lafayette Square. That having the president of the United States walking through that tear gas, staging that moment with the Bible, you could sort of feel people thinking, God, that's enough. And it was closer than we thought, closer than we wanted. And the final point, I'm fully aware that what I just said implies that it took the death of black people in America to push a lot of white people, hopefully, to vote against a regime that was perpetuating a culture of white supremacy. And so these are the most profound of questions. They're immensely complicated. But one thing's not complicated, which is that what happened to George Floyd is a rank and foul injustice and has to be addressed so that we can push on and there will be fewer victims of a system that for far, far, far too long has privileged folks who look like me and you, Joe, than other folks.
Well, another chapter in that story is unfolding not far from the site of the Derek Chauvin trial. The former police officer charged with second-degree manslaughter in the shooting of Dante Wright made her first court appearance yesterday. The hearing for Kim Potter, a 26-year veteran of the Brooklyn Center, Minnesota Police Department, took place via teleconference and lasted about 5 minutes. Potter spoke only once to confirm that she was present. Her next court date is May 17th. Meanwhile, the family of Dante Wright held a press conference yesterday calling for accountability.
There's never going to be justice for us. The justice would bring our son home to us, knocking on the door with his big smile, coming in the house. Justice isn't even a word to me. I do want accountability, 100% accountability. Mm-hmm.
My son was very much loved. We loved him a lot. And the way he was killed, he did not deserve that. These young black men being killed, can you blame my son or anyone else from being scared of the police?
Justice? What is justice? Do we get to see Dante smile? We don't get to see that. Y'all see the difference? This is a taser. This is a taser. But no, my nephew was killed with this, a Glock.
The anguish, oh my God. It's such a tragedy. Paul Butler, was it unusual for the officer to be charged as quickly as she was charged?
It was unusual that it happened literally within days of the event. Often there's a long investigation, but this was an unusual case. Taser mistakes happen, but they're very rare. So there's still questions that haven't been answered. How did this officer with 26 years of experience make this mistake? She was actually training other officers when she conducted this stop of Mr. Wright. The manual for her police department says that officers should not use tasers on people who are operating vehicles, and they should aim for the lower body, not the head or the chest. Mr. Wright was in a car, and he was shot in his chest.
This is the New York Times reported that this has happened before. It is uncommon, but those mistakes are made. I'm curious if you're a prosecutor in this case, if you're looking at what happened, looked at her reaction, the reaction of the other police officers, when this trial, if this trial is ever held and there's not a plea before, is this going to be a more difficult case for the prosecution to put on than, say, obviously more than George Floyd, but what happened in say Charleston or some of these other cases?
It will be, because this is a split second decision. Jurors tend to be sympathetic to police officers and sometimes think even if they made a mistake, they were just trying to do their job. That's why the Chauvin trial is so different, because Officer Chauvin had 9 minutes and 29 seconds to adapt, to think, and the prosecution wants the jury to think that he did not adapt in the way that his training and the criminal law requires.
Mm. Yeah.
Longtime televangelist and conservative host of the 700 Club, Pat Robertson, surprised just about everyone yesterday when he sounded off on the state of policing in America. After reporting on the killing of Dante Wright, he did a demonstration on set showing the difference between a gun and a taser. He then said this.
I am pro-police, folks. I think we need the police. We need their service, and they do a good job. But if they don't stop this onslaught, they cannot do this. You know, the police in Virginia picked up a lieutenant in the Army and began to give him trouble. And our state police are highly trained. But why they don't stop this? And this thing is going on in Minnesota, but the Derek Chauvin, I mean, they ought to put him under the jail. He has caused so much trouble by kneeling on the death of George Floyd. It's just, I mean, on his neck. It's just terrible what's happening. And the police, why don't they open their eyes to what the public relations are? They've got to stop this stuff.
Maybe they need more training. Consistent training. I don't
think
mean training.
The problem is
things,
you've consistent. Got to pay them more. We don't have the finest in the police department. They're low-paid people, Terry. They don't get adequate. It's not a question of training. It's a question of hiring a more superior workforce, and we aren't doing it. But we need police. We need them, and we need to honor them, and I'm all for it. But at the same time, we cannot have a bunch of clowns running around who are underpaid and who really are not the best and brightest. We've got to have the best in there.
Keisha, for people who don't appreciate how influential Pat Robertson is, the 700 Club has been an institution in across this country for many, many, many years. And millions of people listen to the word of Pat Robertson talking about police there. He was referencing the stop of Lieutenant Nazario in Virginia as well. That was for what they thought was not displaying a tag. He did have the tag, and it escalated to the point where he was sprayed and tased. And of course, Dante Wright was stopped because he had expired tabs on his car, and that ended in his death, of course. So I guess the question here is of escalation. Why expired tags are leading to the death of young men in this country?
Well, ultimately, here's where we have to confront a problem that we've been avoiding for a long time, and that is the problem of anti-Black racism, which I'll identify in this moment. And this is partly why Black Lives Matter as a movement has certainly, over the last couple of years, been trying to get Americans to understand that there is no value when it comes to Black people's lives, when it comes to people of color in general. When police officers have encounters with folks who look like me, unfortunately, as we saw play out in the case of Dante Wright, there is no sympathy, there is no understanding, there is just this person encountering an individual and being quite belligerent, not even attempting to de-escalate. And again, an individual doing this who has 26 years of experience. Kim Potter is the only evidence you need. That so-called training is simply not going to cut it. It's not effective, and it's about time that we accept the reality that you can train and train and train all day, but at the end of the day, if someone is going to encounter someone who looks like me and come into the situation without valuing my life, guess what? The result will be the same.
Yeah.
John Meacham, for younger viewers who may not understand the import of Pat Robertson's statement, you and I as Southerners know the cultural impact that he had across the South and the nation. My grandmother constantly had the 700 Club on in her home in Pensacola. It was a big part of Southern culture. In 1988, Pat Robertson ran for president of the United States. He beat George H.W. Bush in Iowa, and I believe Bob Dole as well. And the Republican Party, as it looked throughout the 90s and beyond, was shaped in part by Pat Robertson, in part by Pat Buchanan. Explain to our viewers that may not have grown up with the 700 Club playing in the background of relatives and friends' home, just how impactful that statement is coming from a conservative cultural icon like Pat Robertson.
Yeah, I would say for people who are seeing this and sort of being dismissive about Robertson because of his long history of remarks and activism, go grab a Bible and Google the parable of the prodigal son. You know, if somebody does something right, you welcome it and you welcome him. Robertson was in many ways kind of the mainstream, the kind of official embodiment of the rise of the religious right, which really began, with the school prayer decision in 1962. It was slow in developing. A lot of white evangelicals stayed out of politics in the mid-1960s because they were uncomfortable with civil rights, which was a space that was clearly associated with the black church. Then Jerry Falwell was having breakfast in Lynchburg, Virginia on January 23rd, 1973, opens the Lynchburg newspaper, and there were two stories. One was that Lyndon Johnson had died the day before, and the other was that Harry Blackmun, in an opinion for the court, had rendered a decision in Roe versus Wade. And Falwell couldn't eat his breakfast and felt this compulsion to get into the public arena. It intersected with the 1976 bicentennial, this kind of patriotism surge with this religious conservative surge. By 1980, obviously, it's a key part of the Republican base. And the triumph of Ronald Reagan over Gerald Ford and George H.W. Bush in that era was a clear signal. Then, as you say, 8 years later, Pat Robertson, instead of just having this influence on it, decided he wanted to run himself and won a big Michigan straw poll. It puzzled George H.W. Bush. He thought ministers had a role but shouldn't be running. He was puzzled that they were running for office. What I think this tells us is that people who use the evidence of their eyes and are able to put aside a pre-existing prism and see things for what they are, and what Robertson seems in this moment, and Robertson's also fully capable of saying something else today. So the prodigal son has a very short effectiveness life, is that there is the capacity for us to use, in religious terms, a God-given intelligence. And to say what, if you see it, say it.
So, Chuck Rosenberg, let's bring this back to the trial. The day off today in the Derek Chauvin trial. Closing arguments begin on Monday, could get a verdict back as soon as sometime next week. What will you be looking for first in the closing arguments and then with how quickly the jury comes back or how long it takes to come back?
Well, I'll take the second part first, Willie. I've given up on trying to predict how long it takes juries to resolve cases. The judge told them it could be an hour, it could be a week. Actually, it could be an hour, it could be a month. You never know. But what I'm looking for is what I saw in opening statements from the prosecutors. If you recall, they were relatively brief. It was under an hour. It was very linear and logical. And what I think the prosecution will do in closing is what I tried to do in my cases. I would say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, in my opening statement, I told you I was going to introduce you to the following witnesses, expose you to the following facts, and show you the following evidence. That's what we did. We did exactly what we said we were going to do. We laid out a case of murder, and we laid it out in the ways we told you we were going to do it. In other words, you tie your closing argument to your opening statement, and you show the jury that you delivered exactly what you promised. I think that's what you'll see from the prosecution. From the defense, of course, they will continue to try and poke holes. That's their job. That's the defense attorney's obligation. And so I think closing arguments, prosecution will go first, defense will go second, prosecution will get a brief rebuttal, and the final word. I think those are the themes that you will see on Monday.
All right. Chuck Rosenberg and Paul Butler, thank you both very much for helping us out this morning. Keisha Blaine, thank you as well. We want to mention you are the co-editor of the recent book, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. And still ahead on Morning Joe, the United States hits Russia with stiff new sanctions in response to cyber attacks and election interference, plus a fiery exchange between Dr. Anthony Fauci and Republican Congressman Jim Jordan about when COVID restrictions should be eased, which ended with Congresswoman Maxine Waters telling Congressman Jordan to, quote, respect the chair and shut your mouth. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Welcome back to Morning Joe. 35 past the hour, the Biden administration is slapping tough new financial sanctions on Moscow for a massive hacking operation against government agencies interfering in U.S. elections and strong-arming Ukraine. The State Department will also expel 10 Russian diplomats, the U.S. says, are spies. Perhaps the most notable revelation in the sanctions announcement by the Biden administration was that a business associate of Trump campaign officials in 2016, Konstantin Kalimnik, had provided sensitive campaign and polling data with Russian intelligence services. It was the first time the U.S. government has directly drawn a connection from the Trump campaign to the Kremlin's intelligence services. President Biden warned Russian President Putin of the sanctions in a call, but also proposed that the two meet at a summit.
If Russia continues to interfere with our democracy, I'm prepared to take further actions to respond. It is my responsibility as President of the United States to do so. My bottom line is this. Where there's an interest in the United States to work with Russia, we should and we will. Where Russia seeks to violate the interests of the United States, we will respond. We'll always stand in defense of our country, our institutions, our people, and our allies.
Moscow responded with a statement saying in part, quote, U.S. aggressive behavior will certainly lead to a decisive rebuff. Joining us now, former aide to the George W. Bush White House and State Department's Elise Jordan and columnist for The Daily Beast, Michael Weiss. Good to have you both.
So, Elise, we've been doing this for quite some time, despite Donald Trump's kowtowing personally to Vladimir Putin. Congress passed a series of tough sanctions against the Russians over the past 4 years. We've passed sanctions going back to 2014. What good do more sanctions do?
Joe, we still have not had a robust response from the U.S. president. I think that's what we finally got yesterday when Joe Biden announced these sanctions. And I frankly think that making official what everyone has known, and it has been open knowledge that Konstantin Kilimnik passed along Trump campaign internal polling to Russian intelligence, and solidifying that in the form of a statement from the U.S. government is a big deal. And it's frankly just shocking that it hasn't come earlier. This has been an open secret. I remember about a week, 2 weeks after the Republican convention, an operative who was active in the pro-democracy movement in Ukraine said, watch this guy. Why was he lurking around? Why was he at the Republican convention? KK, Konstantin Kilimnik. And now we finally have formal recognition of the role he played.
So, Michael, Kilimnik is known as a Russian intelligence operative, business partner, friends with Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. So this lays out actually what Bob Mueller didn't exactly get to in his investigation, draws that straight line. I guess the question is, why was Paul Manafort feeding campaign internal documents, internal polling information to a Russian operative to be passed back to the Russian government?
Well, you'll remember in the Mueller report that Paul Manafort owed money to Oleg Deripaska, who was a Russian oligarch, a metals magnate. And I believe the quote that Manafort used in communication with Mr. Gates was, how do we get whole with Oleg? Well, one way to get whole with a Russian oligarch who's close to Vladimir Putin is to feed sensitive polling data from the Trump campaign to a known Russian intelligence officer. And Konstantin Kilimnik's educational background suggests he's an officer of the GRU, which is Russia's military intelligence agency. And you'll remember the GRU was the organization that did that infamous hack and leak campaign against the DNC. There is no way, there's absolutely zero chance that Paul Manafort did not know Konstantin Kilimnik was a Russian intelligence officer, because one of the political consultants who was working in the Manafort orbit, a man called Phil Griffin, the guy who got Konstantin Kilimnik his job at the International Republican Institute in Moscow, told the Washington Post, I think in 2018, yeah, we all know this guy was a GRU officer. It was no big deal. He used to go around bragging about it. So yes, indeed, this is an open secret, but to have the U.S. government finally certify the fact that information was being passed to Moscow is very important. It's important from a journalistic standpoint, but also now let's put the kind of entirety of what the U.S. government has found over the last 5 years together. If Moscow had this kind of sensitive polling data, that will have allowed their intelligence services to better target American electorate constituencies using various streams of disinformation and propaganda, right? The New York Times has a pretty good piece out this morning explaining the import of this revelation. And by the way, contained in this bundle of sanctions is also the fact that there are today English language portals that have been stood up by each and every Russian intelligence service, the FSB, that's their domestic security service, the SVR, their foreign civilian intelligence service, and the GRU, their military intelligence service. So you got the Department of Justice, or the Treasury Department, rather, naming names, which organizations and which so-called fringe media outlets are actually controlled by Russian spies. This is kind of an extraordinary set of revelations, and I haven't even gone through everything yet. That's how much there is to digest here.
Yeah, President Biden calling out Russia for interference in election, the SolarWinds hack, actions with Ukraine and Crimea, a long list that was not pointed out by and large by President Trump. Elise, I want to turn to Afghanistan. President Biden announcing a couple of days ago that by the 20th anniversary of 9/11 this year, coming up in September, that all American troops will be pulled back from Afghanistan and the war would end effectively from our point of view. He's been criticized by people like General Petraeus, even some moderate Democrats, Republicans criticizing him as well as leaving on a date certain rather than looking at conditions on the ground. What is your read on this decision and what its long-term impact may be?
President Biden made the right call. He refused to cow down to what was being counseled to him by a lot of generals who get their power from having more troops deployed on a battlefield. He rejected that advice and chose to look at the broader picture of what's in the American national interest. And 20 years in, after so over 2,200 American deaths, you had 3,800 American contractors and over 100,000 Afghan civilians, he decided that it is not in the American national interest to have a continued troop presence. It's a decision that was overdue. And I hope that we as Americans do the right thing and exit responsibly, and that we take care of our allies who worked so bravely with us for so many years at great risk and threat to their families. I hope that we manage to take care of those allies and to get them visas so that they can be safe and they will not face persecution for their role working with us.
The Daily Beast's Michael Weiss, thank you so much for your reporting. Ali, stand by. Coming up, a ton of new polling on President Biden in recent days. We're going to break down the story it's telling about his performance and his policies so far. Morning Joe's coming right back.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
I'm sure to fall.
Seven past the hour, John Meacham. Oprah recently spoke with you as part of her Super Soul series. That right there is fun. The new episode airs tomorrow on Discovery Plus and will also be available on the Super Soul podcast beginning next Wednesday.
As we look at this picture, I'm just curious. Did Meacham trash his parents?
I bet he did.
And talk about the burden.
I know it.
The many burdens of being an Anglican WASP in rural Tennessee.
Wow. Meacham? I mean,
do you know how hard it is? Do you know how hard it is, you know, to wear the crown, you know, that comes in Chattanooga? Mm-hmm. You know, it's very tricky. It's very tricky.
Right.
I will say this. My father-in-law, to his credit, my father-in-law asked if I had trashed him. So there was that. Because look what happened. Look what happened to Prince Philip a week later.
So. Well, exactly.
Of course.
Oh, right.
He's looking out for himself. So what will Americans learn when this...
This mind melt.
Shocking interview.
Like, why did she do
interview.
This?
I'm sure. Are you and your publicist going to leak it to the Daily Mail first, John?
I don't think you're speaking with the great tone of respect that I came expecting about this. We talked about the arguments in the soul of America, the idea that, you know, it's an imperfect union. It's inherently flawed. But as Frederick Douglass said, there's no soil better adapted to the growth of reform than American soil. And one of the things that we're all grappling with and everything we've talked about, you all have talked about this morning, is part of this theme, right? It is, can an American democracy that is in crisis at home because too many people are not simply recognizing reality and maintaining allegiance to institutions, however frail and fallible, are in fact the product of experience and understanding that we're all fallen and we need these guardrails. And a lot of folks want to take the guardrails away. And that's what you saw 100 days ago today, right, with the insurrection. And so it's a conversation about that. And Joe, if you want to come to the viewing party, we'll see what we can do.
It's been quite a journey from the hills of East Tennessee to Oprah's secret garden for John Meacham. Let's watch some of that conversation with Oprah.
You titled the book The Soul of America. And I ask this question a lot on Super Soul. What is the soul? So how do you define the soul of America?
In Hebrew and in Greek, soul means breath or life. When God breathed life into mankind in Genesis, that word could be translated as soul. When Jesus said, greater love hath no man than this, than to lay down his life for his friends,
life could be translated as soul. So I think it's the essence of who we are. I think it's what makes us who we are. And I also see it as not entirely good or entirely bad. I think it's an arena of contention between those worst instincts, our appetites and our ambitions, against our better angels and our impulses for grace and for love.
John Meacham, you're eloquent as always, and like Nixon, you wear the hard black shoes wherever you are, even on a walk in the garden with Oprah. Very nice.
Yeah. It's a little Adlai Stevenson meets Nixon on the beach.
The new episode airs tomorrow on Discovery Plus.
Willie, also, I've got to say, to quote Caitlin Flanagan, Meacham also looked just like Harry, looked like he had just been shot out of a cannon at the beginning of that interview. But it was very moving. I'm not sure exactly what Meacham said, but was that Meacham's secret garden or was that Oprah's secret garden?
I believe that was Oprah's. It looked reminiscent of other interviews we've seen there. John, are you regretting coming on to promote this interview at this point?
I actually, about 4 minutes ago, I began to have a sinking feeling, and now it's totally sunk. If we to be serious for 1 second,
that's not.
We're still fighting fascism in this country. We're fighting for the future of democracy and the present and the future of democracy. And it seems to me that whether it's the threat from abroad or the threat at home, we have to do all we can. If you believe in the basic efficacy of this system, we have to reform it, we have to perpetuate it, and we have to stand up against folks who want to tear it down because of a will to power.
That is so true. John Meacham, though, I will say, Willie Geist, I spilled my drink in my car because of the sharp turn right there. We go from Adlai Stevenson's wingtips to that.
But it was good, though.
It's very good, and it's very important, too.
Yeah, it's a noble attempt with the Pulitzer.
Noble attempt by John to put us back on the tracks.
It's trying to save us from ourselves, elevate us to our better angels, and John should know by this point that's not possible.
Truthfully, we could listen to John all day, and often we do.
Oh, I know.
The new episode airs tomorrow on Discovery Plus, also available on the Super Soul podcast,
John,
beginning
we love
next Wednesday. John, we love you. Watch John with Oprah. We'll be right back.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.